Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the politics of emotion. How do emotions drive political outcomes like violence, war, and genocide? But first, our next guest has been studying the historic practice of human sacrifice, or what the authors call, quote, deliberate and ritualized killing of individuals as a means of placating supernatural beings. The practice was widespread in early cultures across Europe, the Americas, and Asia. What factors drove the practice? Scholars have examined many reasons, including social catharsis, social stratification, and social control. With us now is University of Auckland Professor Quentin Atkinson. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Quentin. It's great to have you here with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You do fascinating studies, and I was thinking what we should start with is the one, of course, on human sacrifice. I was thinking last night, why did you guys look at human sacrifice in the first place? What drew you to that question?
Well, for a long time, my colleagues have been working on ideas around the evolution of religion. So the supernatural beliefs and rituals and why people all around the world hold these beliefs or perform these rituals. There's lots of theories out there, but one group of theories is that some of these things might be functional. They're helping individuals or a group do something. That's in contrast to explanations that attribute them to just a kind of byproduct. We do these things as a byproduct of our psychology and they don't have any function. So that's a sort of broad research project we have, that trying to work out whether and how elements of human religion might be functional. And one such element is ritual human sacrifice. And it's pretty morbid and seems, you might think it's fairly unusual as well, but if you look at the historical and prehistoric record of human societies, it's remarkably common. We see it all around the world and throughout prehistory and history up until fairly recently. So in the Pacific, where we were working, we see it, but also in the Americas, in Europe, the Germanic tribes were known to do this, in the Middle East as well, in Africa. So it was all around the world. So that raises the question, why was this going on? Why were people doing this?
And it seems like for the most part, they were doing it all in a particular period of time. But you said that it actually was not that long ago in some cases.
So in the data that we have on the Pacific, there are documented cases in the 20th century. And around the world, we see cases that were relatively recent. And according to some reports, you know, in some places, some groups around the world, this is still happening.
It's unbelievable. We think that it's not happening, but that's relatively recent in terms of human history.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's turn to this particular research first, and then let's connect it to some of your other research. I thought we should start with social control theory. What exactly that theory is, because that's ultimately what you've suggested was causing or at least related to the human sacrifice practice. What is this theory?
So there are different explanations for why groups might engage in ritual human sacrifice. There's sort of Freudian theories to do with social catharsis. There's one theory that suggests that human sacrifice is related to dealing with food shortages, somewhat gruesomely, so protein shortages. David Carrasco, who's a scholar of Mesoamerican cultures, developed this idea he called the social control hypothesis, which is that ritual human sacrifice was something used by elites to kind of demonstrate and assert their authority. And so these are sacrifices that are carried out supposedly to appease the gods. And he argues that when they were usually carried out by elites, and when they did this, they were both demonstrating that they were dominant in the society, that they were able to do something as big, I guess, as put someone to death, but also that in doing so, they were merely, that they were sort of exporting the responsibility of it to the supernatural by saying, well, this is what the gods want us to do.
And kind of like the divine right of kings, except for, in this case, whatever the ruler is.
Yeah. So what they're able to show is that they have this absolute authority and it's divinely sanctioned, and that that might undergird or strengthen their status. So the social control hypothesis predicts that where that ritual human sacrifice should be more common in societies that have high status differences, and that it would play a causal role, that it would strengthen these status differences.
And in the end, you decided from the research, from the evidence that you guys found, that this was likely the explanation as opposed to some of the other explanations. What was that evidence?
Right. So what we did was we collected ethnographic data. So this is reports from anthropologists who had visited 93 societies from across the Pacific. And we looked at whether the societies, whether they showed evidence of ritual human sacrifice. And also we looked at how the anthropologists had described status differences in the societies. And we rated the societies as either egalitarian, so everyone's relatively equal in the society, or moderate forms of social stratification where there are status differences, but you might within a generation be able to move up or down the status hierarchy, or high social stratification where there are status differences that endure across generations. And so then we had this collection of data from 93 different societies on ritual human sacrifice and their degree of social stratification. And so we then can treat the Pacific as this kind of natural laboratory to test this idea. And we do this for other hypotheses about the evolution of religion too. But in this case, it was, could we test the social control hypothesis based on the distribution of these traits that we'd coded? So the first thing we found was that indeed, consistent with the theory, those societies that had higher social stratification were more likely to have ritual human sacrifice. So in the egalitarian societies, ritual human sacrifice was relatively rare. It was less than a quarter of those societies. In the high social stratification societies, more than two-thirds of them had ritual human sacrifice. So quite a big difference. So there was this association, but that doesn't allow you to answer the question, well, does ritual human sacrifice play a causal role? So
or
to look
response.
At that, yeah. To look at that, we were able to use what are called Bayesian phylogenetic methods, where we use the languages that each of these cultures across the Pacific speak to trace the genealogical relationships between all the cultures. So most of your listeners are probably aware of Portuguese and Spanish being closely related languages, and we can then relate them to Italian more distantly, and those Romance languages are related more distantly to the Germanic languages, English, German, Swedish, and so on. So we see the same kind of patterns in the Pacific, different languages, obviously, and different timescale. But we use the language relationships to build a family tree of all these cultures. And then we can trace back along the branches of the family tree and reconstruct the evolution of ritual human sacrifice and social stratification. And the basic idea is that if a group of closely related cultures have a particular trait, so say they all have high social stratification, then there's a good bet that their common ancestor also had high social stratification and so on.
Unless they had a Marxian revolution.
Yeah. So this is all sort of a probabilistic thing, and it's done with computer modeling. So it's you're looking for patterns, probabilistic patterns, rather than deterministic relationships. And so we fed these things into these phylogenetic comparative models. And what we found was that societies that have ritual human sacrifice are more likely, well, first of all, they're less likely to lose social stratification. So that suggests that when you've got ritual human sacrifice and social stratification, the ritual human sacrifice somehow sustains it or strengthens it. And the second thing we found was that those societies with ritual human sacrifice are more likely to see increases in their degree of social stratification. So that suggests that ritual human sacrifice doesn't just sustain the stratification, but it causes increases in status differences. So that's consistent with this social control hypothesis, and it supports not just the correlation, but the causal argument.
So the idea really is that those in power are using this to maintain their power.
Whether they know they are or not.
Like it could be a subconscious thing, you're saying.
Yeah.
Like they may really think it's a religious thing.
That's right. But
it serves to act that way anyway.
Yeah. When you look at the societal level, at the level of cultures, this ritual human sacrifice seems to be acting to preserve status differences or enhance status differences.
And one of the things you and I talked about yesterday, which you started to say today, was that it really is sort of the ultimate act of power to be able to take one's life, right? To take somebody else's life. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it automatically does enhance that power. And some of these ways in which the sacrifices were done were pretty brutal, weren't they?
Yeah. So in coding this data, we had research assistants reading the ethnographies and documenting the weird and wacky ways in which people were put to death. And yeah, it was everything from being buried alive to being crushed by a newly built canoe to one of the strangest ones was being rolled off the roof of a house and then decapitated.
Sounds a little bit like what we hear from modern day Middle East right now.
Well, yeah.
The decapitation, throwing people off the roofs of houses.
There may be some parallels there in that perhaps these things were designed to be shocking and evocative. And
expressions of power.
Yeah. And perhaps the way to do that hasn't changed much in the last few hundred or thousand years.
Or have been brought back. You know, and I was thinking that it makes sense that the more egalitarian societies might not have the level of human sacrifice, perhaps partly because they value human life more.
I mean, each other,
like if there's an egalitarian relationship, there's one of the things in your study, and this is where I'm drawing this from, is that the people who were generally sacrificed were of lower status, whereas the people who were choosing the sacrifice or sacrificing the person were of higher status. And so if you had an egalitarian society, there's sort of an indication that everybody has an equal value, you would think anyway.
That's right. So perhaps it makes sense in that way. But still, ritual human sacrifice does occur in these egalitarian societies. So it's not the case that, you know, it's not possible or that egalitarian groups won't do this. It's just
less
likely to.
Yeah. Did you have a sense of like a percentage of the egalitarian societies that did?
It's roughly a quarter, I think.
So about a quarter of them. So still there, but just not in the majority. And then in terms of the ones that were very hierarchical, where there were strong power structures, what percentage was that?
That was about 2/3, I think.
That's
a big effect.
That's a big stretch. In terms of the other aspects of the societies that were practicing this, were there other commonalities in terms of political structure or societal structure? Did you make note of those types of things?
Well, all the societies in our sample were part of the Austronesian language family, which is the biggest language family in the world, and it's spoken across the Pacific. There's about 1,500 languages. So in that sense, they do share a common cultural heritage. But they're remarkably diverse. So they range from small egalitarian societies that have no to little reliance on agriculture, for example, to large chiefdoms or even what we might call proto-states with intensive agriculture, irrigation, and the kinds of things that, for example, we saw on Hawaii. It's one of the largest scale Pacific societies.
One of the other things, we started talking about religion at the beginning of our discussion today and the role of religion. One of the things that comes up is this idea that religion has generally played a role of being a moral compass. But these were done as religious exercises. So it sort of makes you question the role of religion. If you were going to define the role of religion in these societies that were practicing this awful activity, what would you say it was there?
You have to interpret it in terms of the morality of the society, and they might not have viewed this as immoral. So I can't comment on all the societies, but I know some societies where this occurred, it was seen as kind of honor to be chosen for a ritual sacrifice. Now, whether the person who was
and that's why they chose the slaves.
Well, yeah. So it's difficult to know what's exactly is going on there, but it seems like you could argue that whatever the cultural norms were, religion may have been strengthening or undergirding them there. So in that sense, it is supporting the morality. It's just maybe a morality that we might question today.
That would be considered twisted.
Yeah, but that's, you know, that's something that there are plenty of groups around today, different cultures, where they view one another's morality as twisted. And so I think what we can say is that in the case of the ritual human sacrifice, whether or not it was particularly good for the individuals, or particularly some individuals who were put to death, you might argue that it helped solidify and strengthen the social structure and the culture, and so it was functional for the culture. That doesn't mean it was right in some moral way. That's a whole other debate. But the religion might have been functioning for the culture in that sense.
One of the other things that the study said that you and your co-authors published was that this practice was part of what has given us our modern day structure, or implied that. How so?
Right. Well, one of the theories for why religion, and in particular some religious beliefs, are so widespread today is that they do function for the group in some way and allow groups to expand in size, scale, and complexity. So there's this idea that we've been talking about of ritual human sacrifice maybe supporting or allowing societies to build status differences with it, the costs and benefits of that to different individuals involved. Other hypotheses include the idea of supernatural punishment, that religions that involve the belief in a powerful moralizing deity who will punish you if you step out of line might promote cooperation by essentially offering a sort of free supernatural police force. So if everyone believes that they'll be punished if they do the wrong thing, even if this supernatural being doesn't actually exist, if everyone believes it, then people are likely to be more cooperative and better behaved in that society, and it might allow that society to grow and to expand cooperation to a larger scale. So how does this relate to society today? Well, you could view these elements of religion, be it different rituals or beliefs, as sort of social technologies that evolved over the last few hundred or few thousand years that allowed societies to increase in size and complexity. Now, some of those technologies might have been replaced more recently by other technologies. Like, we actually have a real police force now, which might mean there's less of a need for a supernatural police force. We have judicial systems and other institutions that might be able to perform the function of what religion has done in the past. Aaron Norenzayan, who's written a book on big gods, all about some of these questions, talks about how religion might be like a ladder that we were able to climb up, and since then we've kicked the ladder away, but it was nonetheless an important part of the story.
It's interesting also in terms of when you look at things that hold power in place, the things that hold stratification in place, some maintaining power. And even though we don't have, per se, a widespread practice of human sacrifice now, there are other means of keeping these powers in place. And you mentioned the judicial and the police and that sort of a thing. But there are other structures, you know, mass incarcerations and wars, and that seem to be another means of using somebody's life, people's lives, to maintain a power status. Would you say there's some logic to that?
Yeah, well, so it may be that things like mass incarceration or...
Sending kids to war to maintain a particular kind of power.
Yeah, yeah. Or the death penalty, for example, that which we see in countries that do have large wealth differences, like in the US, that might somehow be important and somewhat analogous to some of these other things we've been talking about. But it's a very different modern situation, so I wouldn't want to make too much of those analogies. I think one interesting thing is that where we do see religion today, and you mentioned some of the somewhat high-profile sacrifices or decapitations of people in the Middle East, where we do see that kind of thing is where there's sort of a vacuum in terms of state power and control. So that might then mean that religion can step in and perform some of these functions like it perhaps used to do in a lot more of the world. And that perhaps that's why we're seeing that there.
So then the question of institutions and the role of institutions and what they play in maintaining a particular kind of social structure really is coming in. Like you were saying, maybe it replaces religion, but maybe at the same time it holds the stratification in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it could be... These are very complex. I mean, people are really complex. When people get together in groups, it's even more complex. And so, yeah, I guess we're trying to tease that apart with some of the work we're doing, looking, you know, at these big questions over the long time scale and seeing if we can see some patterns that support one theory or the other. It's more difficult to comment on what's going on geopolitically today, for example, because we can't kind of extrapolate these processes for a few hundred or thousand years to see whether the predictions really hold up.
So we're thinking out loud and speculating out loud about all of that. Yesterday, we briefly talked about this quote that was on your page about understanding human cooperation and how you said it is critical both for unraveling our evolutionary past and for tackling challenges of the future. You started to talk about that now. So how would you elaborate that that is the case?
So it is the case that when the kind of work we're doing, studying the cultural evolution of human cooperation, can give us insights into how cooperative institutions arise and how they fall. And that's really potentially important for tackling some of the biggest challenges facing humanity today. You know, a surprising number of them, perhaps all of them, can be viewed as large-scale cooperative dilemmas, where you've got a problem faced by a collective and individuals need to cooperate to solve it, like something like climate change, but there are plenty of other examples as well, deforestation, overfishing, antibiotic resistance, even in Auckland, where we are now, we have problems with traffic. All these things can be seen as cooperative dilemmas. And so we can learn lessons about that by studying the psychology and cultural evolution of cooperation.
And there were some things that you talked about yesterday in terms of when we choose to cooperate and when we withdraw our cooperation. Could you explain that?
So there's a lot of research in psychology and economics presenting people in a controlled situation with a cooperative dilemma that they have to solve and looking at what factors increase or decrease the likelihood that people will cooperate. And so we can hopefully take lessons from that work and apply it to some of these problems we're facing. So things like one example is that if you give people what's called a public goods game, where everyone gets a little bit of money and they can contribute it to a common pool, and then that pool is multiplied and shared out between everyone else, so they can work together to produce a public good. But there's always the incentive for someone to not contribute and just exploit the public good that everyone else contributed to. So what we find is that put in this situation, most of us sort of hedge our bets and contribute some of what we're given and see what everyone else is going to do. And what tends to happen is that everyone contributes a little bit to begin with, and then cooperation declines as people's expectations are dashed. And so in the end, often there's little to no contribution to the public good. What's interesting is if you change the game slightly and say, well, let's just let everyone vote on what they think the appropriate contribution for everyone should be, then they're willing to vote for high levels of cooperation. And so that can then solve this particular cooperative dilemma. And the reason is because we're conditional cooperators. We're happy to cooperate to solve a collective problem as long as everyone else is cooperating. We don't want to be the sucker who's doing all the work and being exploited. So that suggests that we need to find ways for people in any group situation to conditionally cooperate effectively, but also at higher levels, for example, nations in the sort of international agreements that are being discussed, ways of allowing binding conditional cooperation. We're going to get much better agreement on the level of cooperation if we can do things that way.
Right. So in yesterday, we were talking about that being like an argument for democracy because it gets buy-in from people. And it's interesting, especially today, as we're watching the unfolding of the election in the United States and the parties, completely different approaches to cooperation. One is, you know, we're all on our own, essentially, you know, get the government off our backs. Mm-hmm. And the other being, well, we're all in this together and we have to cooperate.
I think you're right. That is, and that tension between the left and the right in the US really gets to the heart of some of the stuff we've been discussing about how to get people to cooperate and the individual differences between people and when and why they're willing to cooperate.
Well, Quentin Atkinson, it's such a pleasure to get to talk to you about your work. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, how do emotions drive political outcomes like violence, war, and genocide? Stay tuned. I'm diving deeper, deeper for you. Down to the bottom, 2,000 emeralds. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How much do emotions impact or even dictate political outcomes, like ethnic violence, wars, or even genocides? That is a key question posed by international relations theorists, political scientists, psychologists, and communication scholars. Some of the theories relate to the emotion of fear and threat, and the idea that there is no international police force that prevents nations from attacking one another, so all must be prepared. But other emotions also lead to attack: resentment, hatred, and rage. Where do these emotions come from? How do they play out? We're joined by three experts. Roger Peterson is professor of political science at Massachusetts Institute of Technology and has authored numerous books on the subject, including Understanding Ethnic Conflict, Resistance and Rebellion, Lessons from Eastern Europe. David Altide also joins us. He's a professor of political communication at Arizona State University, and his books include Terror, Post-9/11, and the Media, Terrorism and the Politics of Fear, and Creating Fear, News and the Construction of Crisis. And we have with us Jeff Birkenstein. He's professor of English at St. Martin's University, and among his books is Reframing 9/11. I'd like to start with Roger Peterson. Can you first give us an overview about violence and emotions? And maybe you should start even with the international relations literature that pertains to fear and threat, and then bring us up to speed with what you've been doing.
I should probably mention that I have a book which is called A Strategic Use of Emotion in Conflict, and it deals with actually all the Western interventions in the Balkans, especially between Slavs and Albanians. And the premise of the work I'm doing, which builds off the Understanding, I Think, Violence book, is that the West, and by that I mean basically the United States and the European Union, intervene in conflicts by believing they can introduce sort of a rational choice game, that they can arrange sticks and carrots in a certain way to induce behaviors, and the people like the Serbs and Albanians have a little wider view of human nature, one that incorporates emotions, and they see emotions as resources. And they use emotions as resources to basically screw up the game of the Westerners who believe they're imposing a rational game. So there's certain emotions which are very powerful, I think, in being able to be mobilized as resources. Two of them relate to violence, which I think we'll probably pick up on in this conversation, and that's anger and fear. And fear is really based on the cognition that there's some danger, but anger is based on the cognition that someone's done something bad against me. And if you frame what's happened to you in different ways, you can generate either anger or fear, but these emotions, to take a big thing they do, is they shape risk perception. So if you're under fear, you generally tend to upgrade risks, but if you're under anger, you tend to downgrade risks and believe you can retaliate. And sometimes political entrepreneurs wish to inculcate anger if they want to get a violent spiral going between actors. Sometimes they wish to generate fear if they want, especially ethnic cleansing in my cases, if you want to, the other side doesn't believe that they can keep themselves safe, you will separate and you'll get ethnically homogenous groups. So I've spent a lot of years looking to see how political leaders mobilize basically five emotions: fear, anger, contempt, hatred, and resentment. And they would do different things to generate one of those emotions in order to try to mobilize different types of political behavior.
So can you give us an example that really will elucidate for listeners how this actually works, like a concrete example?
If people remember what happened in Kosovo, the Serbs did a massive ethnic cleansing of Albanians, but the Albanians came in after that, and they started, even under Western supervision, they started wanting to intimidate Serbs to leave Kosovo. And really, there are no Serbs left in any of the major five cities in Kosovo today, south of the Ibar River. And if you want, say, in a village, and I was living in some of these villages, if they wanted to create fear, they would leave what they call night letters. They leave a note in the box saying that we have a list of people we're going to go after, and you're number two on the list. When you don't know who put the letter there, where it's coming from, you know, what's going to happen to you or your family, that's a way to generate fear in an opponent, and then the only solution for them was to leave Kosovo. Now, if you were in a situation where you want to create a violent spiral, and before, in 1998, Albanians sort of believed that, in Kosovo, believed that the West was not going to intervene on their side unless violence happened. And so they decided we needed to get a violent spiral, and they hit and attacked certain Serbian policemen, and they attacked the police, not the army, not the other more professional forces. They would attack them in a way, and they would say, we, the Kosovo Liberation Army, killed a couple of your policemen. And they knew that this was going to generate a backlash, because their belief was these Serbian policemen could not control themselves. They would escalate the conflict and generate a violence level, which would trigger Western intervention. So in the one case where the Albanian actors had sort of already won and wanted to sort of create ethnic cleansing, they were creating fear. And by sort of anonymous, sort of, you don't know where the attack might come from. And in the other case, it was, we attack you, you think we're inferior, but the inferior people just killed a couple of your people, and that generated the massacres at Rochuk and other places where the United States decided they had to intervene. So those are a couple examples about how political actors actually calculated, we want to get a certain kind of emotion, and that's going to basically motivate the behaviors they want.
And then on the other side, of course, they took the narrative and framed it in a different way in order to get a reaction from that side.
Yeah, but I think that especially in these conflict situations, there's a lot of material that you can sort of work with. But I think fear and anger, you build on violence, and you use violence in certain ways. Contempt is an emotion that the other side is really deeply inferior to you, and I think in that case, violence isn't a really good tool, but you build on sort of other cultural understandings and cultural schemas.
Let's bring in David Altide. David Altide also studies emotion, specifically fear, and how the politics of fear come about through framing in mass media. So the government using certain frames, and then the mass media just disseminating those frames. Talk about the framing and how certain frames might emerge.
I think that one of the key questions is how we actually decide for audiences which steps we should take. A big part of that is what we call, how is a situation defined? And framing sets that very clearly. For me, one of the biggest examples when we talk about 9/11 was when it started. How would we frame these attacks? Indeed, even the word attack suggests kind of a frame. You know, how would we define planes running into those buildings? Initially, some of the statements were that, well, these are criminal acts. But then pretty quickly that changed to, well, no, they're not criminal acts, they are terrorist acts. And so the difference between a crime and an act of terrorism becomes really significant, because terrorism carries with it, you know, all sorts of other massive state kinds of reactions. And terrorism also, as a term in our society, has a real history with it and some very heavy connotations, meaning things are going to be pretty random, you can't predict anything, there's this powerful but invisible enemy. And so because of that, we then have to take some very strong preventive actions early on in order to stop potential terrorists. And that in turn led to all kinds of things that Jeff might talk a bit more about later, various kinds of acts of surveillance and preventive detention and so forth, not to mention the kind of armed reaction, invasion of countries and what have you. So that basic framing becomes really significant. We find fascinating about the media is that, to some extent, unlike the situation that Roger just really clearly described with the Balkans, the American situation with terrorism was much different, and it really pretty much depended on the mass media. The situation Roger's been studying, the media play a part, but it's much different because in that part of the world, the people involved in the various wars and so forth have a long history of experience and information about themselves compared to their counterparts, the other ethnic groups. And some of that goes back, as I'm sure Roger knows better than any of us probably, for centuries about atrocities and so forth. For more and more of the world, in terms of terrorism, the mass media are the source of the experience and how these things are framed and set up. And so when that happens, then I think the media play a very strong role in promoting actually fear first, and then out of fear comes a sense of danger, and then, for I think most people, as media audiences, anger comes out of the sense of fear about, you know, what's threatening us and what we may or may not be able to do about it, and therefore I'm angry at them, and we must then take some retaliatory action, and then we get into the whole propaganda spiral of sort of framing these enemies in certain very simple ways, justifying actions that we're going to take to protect us. And it's always cast with the notion that whatever we do, we can't do too much in order to keep us safe from these people that we're angry at. And I think that's where the current approach in the world with terrorism has gotten us now, where we're engaged in so much kinds of preventive action, retaliatory action, in order to keep us safe from things that might happen in the future.
I think one of the interesting things that is emerging from the focus now on emotions and political psychology and this merging with political communication is that two things are occurring. One is in the frame, there becomes this kind of good guys and bad guys, the us and the them frame, and that kind of shall we say, instigates a different kind of social psychology. And then you get this framing of the emotions, which, as Roger talks about in his book, has an automatic behavioral mechanism that sort of kicks in like a little trigger. Perhaps that's a good place to bring in Jeff Birkenstein.
So far, it's a very interesting discussion, and I like the connections between Serbia, which was very interesting for me. I was teaching as a graduate student at the University of Kentucky when the United States and NATO went into Serbia, and one of my best friends, she is from Belgrade, she is a Serb, and she came and spoke to my class, and it was just very interesting. We didn't know what to do with it, but it was very interesting to get a very different perspective than our media was then giving. One thing that's really interesting, and I think what David is mentioning, really makes me think about the role of media, even from the maybe first couple hours of 9/11. One of the things I think when you ask people, they have this common experience of 9/11 and the events, because if you were outside of the New York or D.C. or Shanksville or whatever it was, Pennsylvania, forget the name, but of the Pennsylvania area, if you were outside of the immediate impact area, you watched it on television. And everybody watched it on television. So we had sort of this common perception. But what's fascinating is thinking especially about your book, Kill the Messenger, The Media's Role in the Fate of the World, it was almost sort of a reflexive decision that was not nefarious, that probably wasn't an ulterior motive. But if you remember, even from the very beginning, the media, which we tend to believe in our memory, was sort of just, they turned on the cameras and showed us what happened. You remember the example of what's come to be known as the falling man. In other words, people jumping and or falling from the World Trade Center. Well, in the very beginning of the coverage of the attacks, we heard and we saw and people discussed it, and there was even a couple scenes where you saw people fall. But even within the first couple of hours, not as a coordinated effort, but at someone in the who had control of the TV cameras and or what was being shown through the TV was not giving us those images. So even after the first couple hours, those images were being taken away from us. It was a way of protecting us in a way that is unfortunate, I think. And that, to me, is really interesting, just in terms of what David's talking about in terms of media and promoting fear and then anger. Because there was a situation where there was this raw data, if an image of a person falling is can be considered raw data. And it was so raw that there was a reflexive image to cut it off, because you didn't know what would happen when people saw it. And then over time, you know, then very quickly it got into the meme in terms of the frame of 3,000 dead Americans. In fact, I still cringe when I hear that today. I heard it just the other day on a talk news show. Someone said, well, 3,000 dead Americans on 9/11. But we really know that it wasn't 3,000 dead Americans. It was around 3,000 people, many of whom were not from the United States. And so just this way of almost reflexive gut-level framing is extremely influential. And then it does lead to the idea of anger and how people can be controlled in terms of what our response is, et cetera.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. We are speaking with Roger Peterson, David Altide, and Jeff Birkenstein. Roger Peterson is a professor of political science at MIT. His books include Understanding Ethnic Conflict. David Altide is professor of political communication at Arizona State University, and his books include Terrorism and the Politics of Fear. And Jeff Birkenstein, professor of English at St. Martin's University, and his latest book is Reframing 9/11. Roger Peterson, let's talk about the idea that things are unjust or unjust. It seemed universal in the conflicts that you looked at that the framing of this is unfair tended to be underlying all the conflict, and those people are doing something or are going to do something that harms us.
Let me first just to mention what Jeff is just talking about, though, because I think this is sort of interesting. I hadn't thought about the body, but, you know, with a lot of emotion theorists often talk about the cognitive antecedents. What are the beliefs that generate the emotion, and then what's the action tendency of that emotion? If you're under anger, the belief is an identifiable person has done something wrong to you. The action tendency is quite clear. It is to punish that person. Now, fear, though, is a little tricky because the belief is clear that I'm in a situation of danger, but the action tendency could be either fight or flight. There's some speculation. We don't understand this very well. Maybe Jeff and Dave understand better than I do, but I think the framing of the situation, if I am powerless and that's the source of danger, then I flee, then I have flight. But if the perception of danger is
the danger is coming from someone who has power, but I also have power, then the action tendency is to fight back. I think the image of a body falling is really a helpless, powerless image, which everyone sort of intuitively understands this is sort of like fleeing. And I think that the media and probably everybody else didn't want that. They realized relatively quickly that we need to fight back and we can't look so powerless as this body falling down. I think you're picking up on this other emotion, which is of resentment. And the cognitive antecedent, the belief that generates the emotion of resentment, is that my group of people is in an unfair position on a status hierarchy. I think there's a lot of psychology that people think in terms of groups and in terms of group hierarchies. And like in Iraq, the Sunnis had been on top all the time. We came in, the Shia were going to control the country and the democracy by this their raw numbers. And we didn't anticipate at all the power of the resentment of Sunni Arabs to not be able to adjust to not being on top of a hierarchy. In Eastern Europe, because these were empires that crumbled, you had these group hierarchies that were changing, and status reversals are very powerful and very ubiquitous sort of part of politics, which creates this feeling of injustice that you said, and this is another type of powerful motivator. And of course, politicians who are smart concentrate sometimes if they think they can get out of the violence game because the resentment is so powerful of another group, then they will have speeches and parades that highlight the status discrepancies.
Well, wouldn't you say that the resentment is wrapped up with anger in a way, in the way that David Altaïd was talking about fear and anger? First there's fear, then there's anger. You know, this was unfair. They did this to us. This is unjust. And that narrative that fuels it, and that is what is then fueling the larger wars, even, say, perhaps the United States then attacking, well, first Afghanistan and then Iraq.
Well, I think the feeling that, you know, my group doesn't get what it deserves and this resentment, that makes it easier to use anger. But I think the idea about really talking about emotions in a productive way is to try to be very specific about what they're framing, what the beliefs behind them are. And I think it's a different idea that my group is in a inferior status position, which is resentment, and anger, which is somebody has really done something specifically bad against my group, and there has to be some type of punishment for that.
David Altaïd?
Yeah, I think that this starts getting at some of the nub of some real differences in the world. I think one of the other very strong emotions that a lot of us have spent a little time looking at, in addition to resentment, is entitlement. And the notion that we are more deserving than others, that a certain way that we want things is how the world really should work. And so if something has happened that symbolically kind of challenges it, that becomes very important. Because one of the other concepts here that's connected to emotions, but has a bit more to do with how we act in the world, is identity, or how do we see ourselves as being known by others? You know, what do others think of us? And if you feel entitled to a certain approach in the world, how dare anyone possibly oppose us, for example, or how dare anyone in any nation challenge our particular God, or how could anyone dare do certain things that we have been given, if you will, God-given rights to, constitutional right to, and so forth. Those things can then become very powerful in the sense of triggering these other things, that you're taking something from us, I'm worried about losing my rightful place here, and so forth. I remember just briefly after 9/11, for example, and again, that's where much of my focus is, was on the term that a lot of people were saying, Americans have lost their swagger, and that's why some of these actions dare happen. We're entitled to sort of rule and dominate in a certain way, and this sort of thing is not viewed universally in the world that way by all cultures, obviously, but I think certain political systems really tend to promote this as a justification for hegemonic rule.
Jeff Berkenstein?
Well, this is so interesting what David is saying. I mean, his article, for instance, in the book, Reframing 9/11, is Fear, Terrorism, and Popular Culture. And if we remember, post-9/11, there was a big chunk of the country, myself included, who wanted to ask what seemed like a simple question is, why did they do this to us? But at the time, that was a very problematic question because it went outside the frame. The frame was, well, they're animals, they're terrorists, they're bad people. I think George Bush said something along the line, they hate us for our freedom. That might be a paraphrasing. It's been so twisted at this point. But that was the response. And so to ask the question is, well, let's take a look at this. Why, from their perspective, not accepting it, agreeing with it, or condoning it, but why did they attack us? And that question was very problematic. And a lot of people wanted to seek out that information for their own benefit. But the response through the media that really was quite a ringleader in terms of a certain kind of reaction that the American people should have, that was really outside the bounds of acceptable questions at the time. You still had a desire from a lot of people to ask that question, so they were asking it in other ways. One of the ways is through popular culture. They would ask it directly or indirectly in alternate methods, maybe not through the media, or maybe not through what Sarah Palin calls the lamestream media, but all sorts of other avenues. Because people desire information. But at the same time, there's always people who don't want to seek out this information, and that's quite a conflict right there. And that gets right to the sense of entitlement that Americans had, and how could they do this to us? Because we, many people say, are a beneficent power. We're a beneficent presence. We're the greatest country in the world, et cetera. All of these sort of slogans we've been hearing for a long time, those came under attack. And the last thing the media and many politicians wanted to hear, have asked, is, well, why did they do this to us?
That response was also framed in a very distinct way. Roger Peterson, would you like to respond?
If the enemy is just inherently defective, there are different emotions. I think hatred and contempt come into play there. But if the enemy is not inherently defective, but for some other reason did bad things to us, then we're angry, we need to punish them, but I think that the struggle is a little different. If you hate someone, the tendency is to physically eliminate their presence. If you're angry, you just need to punish them. And so it's sort of interesting about how Americans frame these terrorists. Are they a small group? Do they actually have reasons? But once you get into reasons, then we can't hate them, and mm-hmm. we can't have these campaigns to try to eliminate them as much. So I think there was a lot of that going on. I think Bill Maher, right, he said something about the terrorists were that flew the planes in were had some measure of courage or something, and then he had to leave the air because he couldn't attribute.
They may have been a lot of things, Bill Maher said, but they weren't cowards.
Right. And to say even a statement like that, which I don't think is even that controversial necessarily, to attribute anything good to this at the time inherently defective enemy, that generates an emotion. But, of course, if we get into Iraq, we have to say, well, I think George Bush said Islam is a religion of peace, and he has to go out of to try to not have that framing because those emotions become counterproductive at another time.
This is David Altaiti again. One of the things you have to do in order to generate a certain response from your audience and to generate a response that the audience seems appropriate and therefore see you as a leader is you've got to be able to tap some key emotions. And it becomes a real challenge. And so you've got to define things in a certain way. One way that we help do this is through controlling language. And using certain words, Jeff kind of suggested, all but banning the use of other words. And so the language starts changing. And let me give you an example. The United States, and we're not the first country to do this, of course, but the United States in both of these wars with Afghanistan and Iraq has paid a large number of people to help us fight these wars. Historically, in the past, when you pay somebody to fight your war for you, that is to say they're not your own soldiers, they're people who are fighting for pay, we've called those mercenaries. Well, mercenary has a very bad connotation to it. Mercenaries, in the way we've read history and been taught it, mercenary is something that other countries sometimes do, and it's really vulgar and if not immoral to pay somebody to fight your wars. Well, the United States, including the various companies that we paid to fight these wars, has continued to deny that they're mercenaries. And very few of our political leaders ever refer to these folks as mercenaries. And in some ways, it would be refreshing if somebody would say, well, yeah, we're using mercenaries, but, you know, it's cheaper this way, or so what? and just get on with it and then let people deal with that. So they're not mercenaries. They're the contractors, they're consultants, and so forth. Because, again, mercenaries suggest a certain definition of a situation, and a country such as ours is entitled to certain things because, historically, most countries and most groups see themselves as morally superior to the people they're fighting. This is true almost universally. You know, language helps do that in some very important ways.
Well, we are out of time now, but let me just remind listeners that we are speaking with Roger Peterson, David Altide, and Jeff Birkenstein. Roger Peterson is a professor of political science at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His books include Understanding Ethnic Conflict and Resistance and Rebellion: Lessons from Eastern Europe. David Altide is professor of political communication at Arizona State University, and his books include Terror Post 9/11 in the Media, Terrorism and the Politics of Fear, and Creating Fear, News in the Construction of Crisis. And Jeff Birkenstein, professor of English at St. Martin's University, and his latest book is Reframing 9/11. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you, everybody. Great discussion.
Thanks to all who made this program possible: Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Armudian. See you next week.
You know, one of the terrible things, I think, about the kind of consumptive life or consumptive society that we live in is that one of the first things it consumes is our history. And so over and over again, those things that would allow us to make coalitions, to make connections between the things that have happened to us, the things that have happened to our mothers, to our fathers, to people before us, are lost. And as I say elsewhere, we're constantly being put in the position of having to reinvent the wheel.
The Pacifica Radio Archives needs your help so we can restore and preserve another of our 55,000 reel-to-reel tapes in our collection.
I get upset when, even with my own children, I have to remind you, you know, you come from somewhere. You belong to a couple thousand-year-old family. And it's exciting to look back because it gives you ideas for the future.
Go to PacificaRadioArchives.org.
We must admit the past. Only the person who knows her past, his past, can begin to essay where she or he is today and how she or he may begin to chart his tomorrow, her tomorrow.
The Pacifica Radio Archives, the people's history since 1949.